You are listening to
Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It is June the 5th, 2015. The clock keeps moving. The calendar keeps moving. So great to join you at the end of the week so that once again we can play that inevitable game of catch up. And indeed, as always, there is so much to catch up on. I'm awaiting my arrival of my guest, at least electronically, from South Carolina, Hilton Head, my good friend Lauren Martell. But meanwhile, for those of you who are familiar with my program, you know that I'm a retired senior special agent with the former Immigration and Naturalization Service, and that ever since 9/11, I have taken my show, in a manner of speaking, on the road to try to wake up our fellow Americans and our leaders as to the true nature of the immigration crisis that challenges us and that provides so many issues for us simply because the politicians from both sides of the aisle for decades willfully have refused to really secure our borders and create an immigration system that has meaningful integrity. I write frequently about these failures and about the impact it has and what the solutions are. Please go to my own personal website, michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler, one word, .net. Also, for many years, I've been very proud to write for a terrific organization, Californians for Population Stabilization, CAPSWeb.org, C-A-P-S. They have been hammering at this issue tirelessly. Their website has writings from so many experts. I'm just one of many who tackle the various aspects of the immigration crisis, and certainly California is, if any state is a poster child, it's California. I'm not going to blame the drought on immigration, legal or otherwise, but certainly when you have limited resources, you have a problem if more people come around showing up looking to share those scarce resources. And that's really what immigration in part is about, making certain that we don't overburden our nation economically, ecologically, financially, or from a military perspective. So there are many reasons why immigration needs to be carefully and effectively dealt with in a humane and honest fashion. Of course, that's not happening. Additionally, I have become a columnist for David Horowitz Freedom Center's terrific front page magazine. They do such a terrific job. Again, I join a whole slew of terrific authors who write from a vast diversity of backgrounds, experiences. But again, to try to show the American people what is going on because of failures of leadership by our own government, along with so many other issues, of course. Their focus is far more diverse. I also write for Progressives for Immigration Reform. And as their name implies, they are indeed progressive. They stand on the left side of the line. And let's face it, this is not about left or right, folks. This is about right or wrong. I think that what we've been witnessing in a country is Americans being goaded, being coerced into fighting among themselves, among ourselves, so that while we're busy duking it out, we ignore the damage being done by the top one percenters and by the politicians acting at the behest of those who are really pulling the strings of power through the vast wealth that they have accumulated. I also write for The Social Contract. I just completed a massive article. It will be their feature story in their fall edition, where we will look back at where we are 14 years after the terrorist attacks of 9/11 from an immigration perspective. You know, this idea about where in the world do we now stand so many years after 9/11, not realizing, I guess our politicians not realizing, just how critical the immigration issue is for all of us and how it impacts national security. And that really is wherein lies the major problem, that what we're witnessing now is a real problem. So what I'm trying to do as best I can through this program, through my writings, through public appearances, is to try to wake everybody up as to what these problems really are and what the solutions are. I see my guest is on the line, so I am going to go ahead and bring her on. Lauren Martell, happy Friday.
Michael Cutler, how are you?
I am terrific. Better for hearing your voice on my program. I thank you so much for joining me. I was just explaining to my audience that we're going to be looking at this multifaceted issue of immigration today, ably assisted by the lovely Lauren Martell from Hilton Head, South Carolina, a beautiful part of the country. I've been there. Wish I was there right now. Why don't you tell my audience a little bit about yourself, Lauren? And thank you, by the way, for joining me tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always an honor to be on your show and to talk about these serious issues. Can you hear me okay? Because I have the
I hear you just fine.
Great. Well, things are down here just beautiful. Hilton Head in South Carolina is a particularly lovely place to live. And so, considering these issues are so important, I had to, you know, cancel and postpone until later my walk on the beach so that I could come here and join you.
You're just telling me that to aggravate me. I know why you're throwing that in.
It is a beautiful beach. We are going to be bringing you down here, you know, within this year, before this year is out. I am sure that you will have a trip down to South Carolina again. I am blessed to have a law degree from Syracuse University, which was an excellent school and taught me how to think logically and also to, you know, really care a lot about the law in America. And, of course, that's up in central New York, so, you know, that's where I spent half of my life. And I'll tell you, that is probably where, you know, you get the strong constitution living in the snow and the cold, and central New York is particularly dreary. But,
you know, when the lawyer talks,
I
got to interrupt you. When a lawyer talks about constitution, which one are we talking about? Your personal constitution or our country's constitution?
That's exactly right. Well, it's a great analogy, and you know. From my perspective, I really think that self-government really starts with ourselves, and that's something that's really important. So we should. It depends on what kind of constitution we have as individuals, but then, of course, there is the United States Constitution, which is just an amazing document, and you know how much I respect that document. And,
as do I.
And I want to continue to, you know, educate myself on it and educate others around me. So that I think that's really a key is education. That's a word that's important, and it's a word that, you know, we can't take for granted, because the idea of education is not necessarily indoctrination. So one of the reasons why I enjoy so much being on your show is because whether or not we end up with a complete agreement on issues, we critically think through issues, and we're able to logically process the debate and end up still civil and friends at the end of the day, and I love that part.
You know, it's so funny, because as I was waiting for you to call in, I was just saying that to the audience, that this isn't about left or right. You know, this battle of one side against the other is really a divide-and-conquer strategy. The Founding Fathers understood the need for debate and discourse, the right for peaceable assemblage is part of the First Amendment, because they understood the need for debate. They understood that not everyone is going to agree on every issue. So what they simply said was, have those debates, and you're free to do so. Just keep it peaceable. Keep the guns, the knives, and the clubs out of the discussion, but have at it. And, you know, what I find remarkable is that today, how quickly Americans are willing, from both perspectives, vilify those they disagree with, and that is so anti-American and so opposite what the Founding Fathers believed in and what so many soldiers over the last quarter millennium have died for. We should celebrate the fact that we can have the discussions and hopefully arrive at reasonable solutions to the issues that we confront. Don't you agree?
I do. I absolutely agree. And that is really what higher-level thinking people do anyway. They don't necessarily react emotionally and, you know, very similar to us discussing, you know, very serious topics, never taking it personally. See, that is a way to win. You know, obviously, as an attorney, I know that that's certainly a strategy in the art of war, or the art of winning strategy toolkit, but it's not necessarily always the right thing for the ultimate outcome. And, you know, certainly just as you said, our you know, forebears understood that sometimes you might even discuss a piece of legislation that's potentially going to be a new law for up to a year, because they wanted to talk about the law of unintended consequences. How is this going to have a ripple effect on future generations, and the effect of the law of the land as it was? And so these discussions are absolutely crucial. And you know, what happens in D.C. now is they barely give them time to read it, let alone process it, think about it, and have a rational discussion about these kind of issues. And then they pop in legislation that's got so many different things buried inside of it that nobody really knows until they actually create a law that they have no idea what's going on. And so to that being said, you know, that's been something that has turned into the status quo of the way things are done. But I don't think that it's necessarily been to the benefit.
I hate interrupting, but I was looking at some of Harry Truman's quotes, because I really thought Harry Truman was a great president. And he had this really wonderful quote that you're going to enjoy. Just thinking of what you just said, Lauren, whenever you have an efficient government, you have a dictatorship. How's that?
That's great. That is, it is, and isn't it true, though? You know?
And so now look what Obama has done. And I got to turn my attention, because it's just, you know, staring me in the face. So let me vent my spleen. This is cheaper than a psychiatrist's couch. When Obama stood in the Rose Garden on June 15th, 2000, and I believe it was 12, and he talked about the Dreamers, and he said, Congress has failed to act. And we hear this all the time. That's the refrain in the background. Congress failed to act. Folks, voting no is not a failure to act. Congress voted down what they believed, and I believe, was bad legislation, the Dream Act. And so they said no. And he referred to their vote as a failure to act. Saying no is action. But, you know, I do remember there was once this state legislator, I think in Chicago. I'm trying to remember his name. But I remember that he voted present quite a few times, which meant that there was no answer. You know, I think his initials were Barack Obama. Am I getting that wrong? So when I hear this nonsense about a failure to act, voting no is just like the parent who says to that kid that didn't do his homework, hey, you've got to turn paper, and I'm not giving you the keys to the family car until that paper is ready to be handed into your teacher. So sit down and get back to work. Is that a failure of a parent to act by saying no to that child? Is it a failure when Congress says no to bad legislation? What do you think?
Well, is this whole thing... no, I think you're I think you're right, and I think your logic is sound, and your argument wins. But I think also that, you know, that is a strategy of going to the emotions of people and trying to shut them down. It's sort of both the Republicans and the Democrats have done this, and I liked what you said, that these issues are no longer partisan issues. They're really American issues. They're just decent, you know, a decent society needs to just recognize, you know, you either have a decent society or you don't, and it has to be based on some sort of law and balancing, you know, the freedom, as we just talked about, that self-government, you know, our founders really wanted everybody to individually have an equal opportunity to make some decisions on their own and not to be told exactly what to do, because we have brains. We have brains to think and to choose and to have free will. But, you know, that's kind of the, and this sort of sounds like a little, you know, generalizations, but the kind of Saul Alinsky or Cloward Piven strategy, but we use it every day. I mean, people use it, you know, it's projection 101 in somebody who's maybe doing something bad. They might be the one that's the perpetrator, but they want to say that the other person's doing it. So it's a projection. And Obama seems to be just very good at that, but there are quite a few Republicans that I can name. There's so many more that I don't even have fingers on my hands.
And that's why politicians are what they are. And, you know, so Truman had this other quote. I'm sitting here looking at all these Truman quotes this evening. my obsession for the evening, Harry Truman. But he said, this was Harry Truman's words. My choice early in life was either to be a piano player in a whorehouse or a politician, and to tell the truth, there's hardly any difference. That was what Harry Truman had said.
That's a good one, too. It really is. And it's sad, but even the best of them go and they get a taint. And it's easy to do. And here's one of the things, again, you know, watching your own self. Because every day we all get up and we make so many choices, you know, more choices than we probably even consciously are aware of, the choices that we're making. But each individual person is competent and capable of making many of these choices. And they may not be the best result for them or whatever, but people are making these choices. So, you know, we've got our politicians. They're normal people too. We put them out on a different level, and they put themselves out. They separated themselves out, insulated themselves from some of the laws, which has created, you know, the failure of checks and balances that should be innately in there. And so when I'm making decisions and I have something where I feel like I have a blind side, you know, or I might not be situationally aware and I have a blind side and I need to get somebody to give me a, you know, confirmation of what's going on, or, you know, just run decisions through people, which is smart, right? And so these people, they have their circles of who's, you know, communicating with them. But not everybody who has gone up in those circles, what their plans are for America.
Well, let me address that, because this, what you're saying is really important, and I don't want to cut you off, but I think it's important, and I want to be more than just talk about generalities, because that's not going to help our audience. You know, in Washington, and I've dealt with D.C. now, it's hard for me to believe this, but I started working with the political side as an American. I've only done this as an American. I'm not a paid lobbyist or anything like that. But in the early 80s, I approached Senator Al D'Amato, and I was an agent at the time, because I was concerned that we weren't prosecuting aliens who were deported and came back illegally. And if you tried to get the U.S. attorney to prosecute those cases, they'd say, look, Mike, these guys are only going to get 2 years in jail max. Why bother? By the time we're done with the whole process, they're going to get time served. And then I thought about 2 years in jail for reentry. And you know what? If you're a dishwasher, if you're a farmhand, if you're working in a factory, really, 2 years is probably the right penalty for unlawfully returning. But if you're a criminal, then it should be a lot more, except back then the law made no distinction. So I approached Senator D'Amato with a unique idea that I had. I said, why don't we create a separate set of circumstances whereby aliens who are convicted of serious crimes face more than 2 years in jail for reentry? And I recommended that it should carry a 20-year maximum penalty for drug dealers, child molesters, rapists, arsonists, that sort of thing. And you know what? We got the law passed. But in working with Al D'Amato, I started to learn how Washington functioned or didn't function. So I have 30 years with the INS, but now I have almost 36 years or 35 years working on the political side. And what most people don't know is that access to the Congress is controlled by a bunch of relatively young people, for the most part, who've come to Washington mostly from the Ivy League schools. Many of these kids are well-connected. Not all. I don't want to paint with a broad brush. But so many of these kids, because they're in Washington, because they went to the Ivy League schools, and they've been drinking the Kool-Aid, frankly, with not one but two straws, think they have all the answers. And there are some politicians, partially because they are overwhelmed, and they are, but also partially because some are lazy, don't read the law. They'll turn to a staffer and say, hey, Charlie, can you read this and tell me what you think? And then Charlie comes back and says, Congressman, that's great legislation. Now, what the congressman might not even know is Charlie has been interviewing with a lobbying outfit. And the lobbying organization says to Charlie, hey, listen, Charlie, finish out the year working for Congressman Schmidlap. But after the year, we'll put you to work for us, and I'll double your pay the first year and triple it the second year. But you have to prove to me you can deliver. And how you deliver is get the congressman to vote this way on this issue and that way on that issue. And so now you have a kid sitting in a congressman's office with access to that congressman. But what's unknown to everybody is the agenda. And one day I thought about that, and I asked some of the friends that I have on the Hill, I said, how far-fetched is my scenario? And the guy looked at me and said, you've been snooping around too many offices, apparently. Now, think what that
means.
Well,
that's funny. That's confirmation of what I was just kind of saying, is about the blind spots. And these senators go up there, and these, you know, the House members, and they get really busy. And if you don't have the people around you that are, you know, going to be in line, then it's very easy for even the best of people to fall short in what they're supposed to do.
But, you know, one of my friends, he's a personal friend as well as a member of Congress, Lou Barletta, who is the mayor of Hazelden. For those of you not familiar with him, if you haven't gone to my website, please go to my website, michaelcutler.net. I write frequently about Lou, capsweb.org, front page magazine, Progressives for Immigration Reform. Lou Barletta was the mayor of Hazelden, nice guy, in a quiet town in Pennsylvania, very picturesque setting. It was a mining town many years ago in the mountains. And all of a sudden, he found a Dominican drug gang had set up shop in his community, and suddenly they had homicides where they hadn't had a murder in many years. He had a couple of murders. He had other crimes.
Yes.
In fact, C-SPAN covered an event where he and I went to a university in Florida, and we sat on stage. It was kind of like an actor's studio, sort of an interview. It was Congressman Barletta, myself, and Mark Bernier, a radio talk show host from WNDB down in Daytona Beach. And Lou detailed this particular case. And when he went to the Bush White House, George W., again, it's both sides of the aisle, they basically said, hey, you know what, Mayor? We don't have the resources. You're on your own. Lots of luck. The best we can do is give you a mug with a badge on it. I kid you not. So he enacted America's first local ordinances to go after people who intentionally hired illegal aliens or intentionally provided housing to illegals, figuring that this was the common denominator. These gangsters were here illegally. Let's move illegals out of the community so we know who we're dealing with, which is a rational, law-based response. He was immediately sued. I was his final witness at the trial, which is how we know each other. He's now a member of Congress representing those same people, but in Washington, and he sits on two subcommittees over at Homeland Security. And I remember one day we were sitting there having dinner in Florida with his chief of staff, Andrea, who's terrific. And these are great people that he's hired. He's very, very selective about who works for him and how they comport themselves.
Yes.
You know, you look at the staff, you learn a lot about the congressman or the senator. But here was what he said to me. And he said, and I'm sitting here with my chief of staff. I trust these people. But he said, the people who elected me did not elect them. They elected me. So I have to keep my hand on the tiller. I have to know what in the world we're doing. And on occasion, when bills concerning immigration have come up, it's not a shocker to get a call from his staff, or sometimes Lou himself will call me up and say, Mike, we're kind of in a rush. There's a bill that needs to be voted on tomorrow. If you were a member of Congress, what would you do? And then we have not a five-minute conversation. I remember one conversation lasting 2.5 hours. Going over the pros and the cons. And he voted the right way, in my judgment. But how many members of Congress are willing to make the effort? How many of them bow down to the power elite? Remember, there's a character on the Hill called the whip. And the whip is supposed to keep the members of the party in line. And if the title, the whip, doesn't sound like a mob enforcer, I don't know what does. So you have to understand the pressure being brought to bear. And if the party doesn't like somebody, they stop giving them funding for their reelection campaign. And I can tell you that I know some members of Congress who I thought did a great job, but because they upset the power elite above them in both parties, suddenly couldn't get 10 cents to run for reelection and found themselves out on the street after the ballots had been cast. So there's an awful lot of pressure being brought to bear, which is why the American people need to be involved. You see, what's happening now is the special interest groups are ruling the whole deal. If Americans voted, if Americans were informed, which is why I'm so thrilled to be doing this program, because I know my audience is well informed, they try my best, and I know they're motivated, but how many people, when you saw Jay walking, when Jay Leno was over at Channel 4, you know, NBC, and they would ask people, who's your congressman? Goodness, you might as well have asked them what, you know, the snowfall was 15 years ago in the Himalayas. They look perplexed. They say, gee, I have no idea. And we're talking about the people who represent them and their families in Washington. I think the first step, folks, is changing that dynamic. And that's why I hope I get out to your neck of the woods, by the way.
Yeah, that comes from education, and that comes from you know, but you just said so many wonderful things there, and one thing that clicked in with me is you just basically said that there's a power elite above these people, and that's where we're really hitting the disconnect button. You know, people kind of like, what's wrong? It feels like something's wrong, but you can't really identify it, and that's really what it is that through the back door, the things that normally are supposed to function in a healthy way are being circumvented. So basically, we've got an abnormal governmental sort of tumor that's causing kind of a malignancy, you know, within the country. So people are saying, you know, we feel, you know, if you imagine our country being a body, it's fatigued, it's overstressed, it's, you know, things aren't functioning the way they're supposed to be functioning. And so then the question becomes, you know, how long can we get it back healthy again? Or how long can it be sustainable before it either, you know, implodes or something happens? And I know one of the things that you asked, you know, that we had discussed that we would be talking about, and I was happy, actually was very interested in digging into the research on it, you know, were some of the issues that are going on, you know, recently right now, as we're seeing, you know, the issues dealing with the Patriot Act, issues dealing with immigration, issues dealing with, you know, some of these refugee camps. We have one coming up here in Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Yep.
And as I was doing the research on it, Michael, you know, I looked at a couple of recent quotes now, and I'm telling you, I don't think Marco Rubio is any Harry Truman. I'm just going to say that right out of the gate here. But this is a quote.
I don't think I'm going to argue from, with you, but go ahead.
This is Marco Rubio on the floor. And you and I know how, you know, you and I have talked about the, let's just talk about the details of this particular thing, but what I'm going to do is make an analogy to this statement. To another statement. So Marco Rubio says, if NSA isn't extended and reauthorized just the way it was under the Patriot Act, not under the new U.S. Freedom Act that they're talking about, he says, if it is not extended and reauthorized and there is another terrorist attack within the USA, Congress will be, and this is, quote, under fire for explanation whether a program could have helped prevent an attack. So that's the end of his quote there. And, I mean, taking each one of those words, I kind of wanted to dissect it almost word for word because it ends up getting you to different issues. But let's just table the under fire because, you know, I'd love to know what else we could do to Congress when they act badly besides vote them out, you know. But obviously Marco Rubio says that they can be under fire. Here is the other – this is his logic, okay? Let's use Marco Rubio's logic right there. And then let's go back – a few years to when you were involved with the 9/11 Commission report, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here
I
my
knew
point.
You were going to go that direction, and I was thinking the same thing. So keep going, Lauren. You're right on path. You're right on the track.
Yes. Well, my point is that things have already happened in our country since the 9/11 Commission report was openly, you know, given to all the Congress people, put them on notice, said. Just like, you know, you would, you know, we've discussed before, if a car crashes, like the Pinto, and it's got a problem with it, and some expert comes in and says, look, if you don't want to have this car, you know, go catch on fire anymore and kill people, this is what you have to do, X, Y, and Z. Implement that right away, and people will be safer. And then let's say they just ignored it and people keep going. Well, that's what the 9/11 Commission report was.
All right, so let me jump in and do this. Let me read something to the audience.
Yeah.
And let me make a point. Okay. There's an article that I think will be coming out on Front Page Magazine this morning, and then I want to talk, you know, when I say this morning, midnight tonight, tomorrow morning. And I also want to talk about an article I just wrote for them and also for Californians for population stabilization. So let me start out with the 9/11, with what I wrote for CAPS, CAPSweb.org, and I called it Bin Laden, the 9/11 Commission Report and Immigration. And what's remarkable, I don't know, I'm sure you followed this, because I know you follow everything. You're such an astute observer. But the government, just within the last few days, released at least a partial list of the library that was recovered at the Bin Laden compound when they took that piece of garbage out, when the Navy SEALs did their thing, proved what America is made of, and proved how brilliant and courageous and valiant our people are. And they took out that human bit of detritus, and they found a library in his compound. And among the documents was a copy of the 9/11 Commission report. And so I included that, by the way, this fact, not only in my article for CAPS, but in this major article that I just submitted to Social Contract. It's a 50-page document, a retrospective. And what I referred to it was this idea that we don't learn from history. And in my article, I referred to the 9/11 Commission report as the history book. So the question, and the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel are two history books. And so it would appear that Bin Laden read the history book. My question, listening to what Rubio had to say, is, has he read the 9/11 Commission report? I want to know how many members of Congress who stood before the microphones and stood before the cameras and thumped the podium and thumped their chest and screamed about why didn't they connect the dots. I wanted to send these idiots a box of crayons. How many of them has since read the 9/11 Commission report? Because that was the purpose to the report. But then, you know what they also found in the Bin Laden compounds? An application for United States citizenship. Now, they just fired, and this is going to be the article that I wrote for Front Page Magazine, and it should be up, I hope, tonight or over the weekend. I know they don't usually post too much on Friday nights. But what I wrote was, it's obvious that Bin Laden wasn't looking to become an American citizen. But I know that he was looking to embed his terrorists in the United States. In fact, they made a point in the reports of saying that Bin Laden was absolutely adamant about launching more large attacks inside the United States. The best way to operate inside the United States is to acquire a United States passport. So Bin Laden has a copy of the 9/11 Commission report. He's got a copy of the application for citizenship. You have Chuck Schumer and all these other pieces of trash, and I'm not trying to make this personal. I'm not trying to resort to name-calling, but my blood is boiling.
In my opinion, this piece of trash.
And I have to say that, because how can you stand there and say that we need to make a 5-year federal crime of those who would trespass on landmarks like the Brooklyn Bridge, like the Manhattan Bridge, like the Statue of Liberty. But when you trespass on America, then you should be given United States citizenship. Everybody in Washington understands that there is no interviews being done. In fact, I included in my article, if they've included, I don't know, they hopefully did, a couple of links of Lou Barletta challenging Jay Johnson, the head of DHS, the agency I've come to call the Department of Homeland Surrender. And he challenged him and said, you can't even interview these people. How do you do this? And Jay Johnson did the best tap dance this side of Richard Gere in the movie version of Chicago, if you remember that great tap dance that he did in the courtroom. That was Jay Johnson without the benefit of music at that congressional hearing. And you had Lou Barletta hammering him and saying, why is it you keep telling us what the immigrants want and what the immigrants need? When will you talk about what's in the interest and concerns of Americans? And Jay Johnson just looked at him and had nowhere to go with it. And what Lou did that I've recommended to him, and I've asked others to do, but Lou is Lou and he's just fabulous. I want to be the president of his fan club. He has read the components of the 9/11 Commission staff report during congressional hearings, and he's confronted witnesses for the government and said, have you followed this? Are you doing that? Are you ignoring this? And they all sit there with that dopey look on their face.
Yeah, that is exactly in line with where I was going, and I want to follow through just a little bit with it, because I submit to you that he is a one percenter up there, or just very few have read like as detailed as he should. And everybody up there should have read it all, and they should have read the 9/11 Commission and Line in the Sand. But let's go back to what you just said in the beginning of our conversation about where Obama in the Rose Garden was pointing a shame finger at Congress, saying that they had failed to act. And actually, when they were just doing their jobs, right? And he just didn't like the outcome of their action.
Right.
But let's talk about that DREAM Act, okay? That DREAM Act, think about the time and the money that was spent putting that DREAM Act together, and that is absolutely counterintuitive to the 9/11 Commission report. And so Rubio, Schumer, McCain, Lindsey Graham, you know, these people are all part
of
this.
All the all-stars. You're naming the all-stars, the 8 gangsters.
I'm naming somebody who's running for president. Well, all of them are running for president now, right? So
that's right.
This is where
except
they
McCain.
Have to be
except
caught.
McCain. He's running for I don't know where, but okay.
He's you know, probably hanging out with Lindsey. But the point is here is this is ludicrous at this point. And this is a real issue in real time that every single American can understand. Immigration and the legal immigration is fine, and if the laws are followed, that is fine. illegal immigration has crumbled our economy. It has crumbled our educational system. It has crumbled our security.
I'm going to challenge a statement you made, though. The legal system is worthless today, and I'll tell you why. There is no integrity to that system because there's no integrity to our government. And what I mean by that is this. Our immigration laws were enacted for two primary goals. Protect innocent lives, not just American lives, anybody in the United States, to keep out the criminals, the terrorists, and so forth.
And the disease.
To protect American jobs. When you can bring in foreign workers and displace American workers with foreign workers, I don't care if you're meeting the letter of the law, you're certainly not meeting the spirit of the law. And we start with Southern California Edison Power, when they just fired hundreds of IT workers who are Americans, replacing them with people from India. Walt Disney just did the same exact thing. And I've written about it in an analysis of Rand Paul's candidacy for Progressives for Immigration Reform. And I just did it again when I looked at Martin O'Malley. And I want everyone out there to understand something. My son came to me today, and he's a sharp kid. He's an engineering student, but he pays attention to everything. So my son comes to me and he said, "Dad, how can they say it's a good thing that the unemployment went from 5.3 to 5.5%? I said, "Well, they can say it if no matter what happens, you try to put a good spin on it. Because now the claim is that the reason that this is good is it shows more people are looking for jobs, so they've jumped off the sidelines. Those 93 million Americans that we forgot about, oops. I didn't see all those people standing there, 93 million, the Americans who are no longer part of the labor force. So some of them have suddenly said, I'm looking for work. I doubt it sincerely. Let me tell you what's really happening, because I did some digging for the article about O'Malley, and I've got this information in there.
Right.
And I'm hopeful that they'll be publishing it next week. I looked at the remittance.
Let me just insert here quickly before you get into O'Malley that systems don't necessarily fail for a lack of integrity. It's very much like, you know, guns don't shoot people, people shoot people. Systems are in place, and our legal system is
yes, I'm getting to that, Laura.
The people,
but being administered,
the people are the
as
ones.
An agent,
yes.
As an agent, I was given operating instructions, and I was given policy. And to an agent in the street, policy is the same as law. It's indistinguishable. Understand that.
Right.
And people say to me, well, those agents ought to arrest these people. Well, some agents did go out and make arrests that they were told not to arrest. They found themselves suspended. And they will do that.
Uh-huh.
Because we've established the priorities. Now, to an extent, that works. And that goes back to this idea of prosecutorial discretion. Cops out there exercise some prosecutorial discretion. I'll give you an example. You're driving down a highway. The speed limit is 60. You're going 68. It's a dry road. There's nobody out. You're in a new car with not doing anything crazy. You're in the middle lane, and you're going 8 miles over the limit. The radar picks you up, and the cop looks at the radar and says, yep, she's going 8 miles over the limit, not tailgating, not swerving. The car is in good condition. The roads are dry. I'm not going to bother her. Why? Number one, I don't want to be, unfair. Maybe, people tend to be a little bit whatever. The other thing is, if I wait another 10 minutes, someone's going to come down here going 90 miles an hour or driving drunk or wobbling all over the road. That's the guy I want because he's a danger. That motorist who's driving safely at 68 isn't a threat. I want someone who's a threat. That's prosecutorial discretion. And Obama said that because of a lack of money, a lack of resources, he was using prosecutorial discretion to enact the DREAM Act without legislation. So understand something. It's not that he's ignoring hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens. That's prosecutorial discretion, and we could have a discussion about that. What he did was to take resources he did not have, to spend money they did not have, to bring those people in and give them lawful status. This is no longer prosecutorial discretion. Okay? Prosecutorial discretion would have been to say to the agents, if you encounter an alien who's under the age of 25, and if that alien, you run their fingerprints, turns out to not have any warrants on them, let them go. Don't proceed further. We just don't have the time or money to waste. We want you out there getting convicted felons. I might agree with it. I might disagree. But that's a valid form of prosecutorial discretion. But when you bring them in, and start to process them and issue them documents, and you have to spend megabucks to create the documents and to hire people to process, what happened to prosecutorial discretion? And then, of course, they wanted to have the follow-up, DAPA, the parents of the resident aliens. Again, prosecutorial discretion? No, now it's not even about children. Now it's everything's off the table. So we now have the government running both a legal and an illegal immigration system. So that blows away any theory that this was prosecutorial discretion. But the point that I wanted to make, though, Lauren, is that the agents are confined by the instructions they get from their bosses when they go on duty. Because if the boss says, this is what you're doing today, it's like being a soldier in the Army, and the general says, we're going to charge up that hill. You don't look at the guy and say, no, we're going to take a rowboat. We're going to go out on the lake. No, he just told you you're going up the hill. You're going up the hill. That's the end of the conversation.
Right.
So you know, and I want people out there to understand, don't blame the agents. There's a great Yiddish expression that says when the fish goes bad, it smells from the head. But I just wanted to get into what this is doing to the economy. And this is why it's against America's best interest. You're talking about national security, and we'll revisit it. But I did a little bit of digging. Last year, the World Bank said that the government of India, or the economy of India, gained over $70 billion, with a B, $70 billion in money wired home, remittances. That's the visible money. More money moves covertly that they don't track. But at least $70 billion flowed into India. America lost probably about $125 to $200 billion in money being wired out of our country by these foreign workers that we're giving permission to work now. So when money leaves the economy, it hammers it. Now, guess what? Friday of last week, just a week ago, they issued a report that said the U.S. economy, the GDP, contracted by 0.7%. Guess what the India economy did? It went up by 7.5%. And I'm not going to say it's only about remittances, but tell me, Lauren, do you think it's unreasonable to say that the remittances, the inflow and outflow of money at that level, has a significant impact? Is that an unreasonable presumption?
No, it's absolutely true. And see, none of the people who are running to be leaders of our country are talking about this. And that is, you know, my level, a slight level of frustration, because, and then I step back and I understand why, because none of them really want to breathe the life back into America through this kind of thing. But it's absolutely common sense. If you keep the front door and the back door open and everything's going out of your house, you're not going to be left with a whole lot. Your resources dwindle. And then along with that, you know, esteem and things like that, you know, it's got a ripple effect on every level of, you know, the American family. And the economy has just fueled it. You know, you don't even have to have an expert degree or anything to know that there's, you know, something critically wrong.
But now look what this does.
But what you were talking about the prosecutorial and those kind of things, all of those are in sort of crisis mode. And, you know, a lot of, let's say when I'm doing a personal injury case, you know, people, they have the wreck, right? And then they go to the ER usually. And when they're in the ER, the doctors there just figure out whether you're going to live or die, right? And then they do what they need to do for that little level of it. And then they go off and they go home.
The idea
and
of a triage, basically, a triage.
Right. And so where the, like, Obama leadership and this kind of stuff where he's saying, like, Dream Act has to happen now, that is not a, you know, you're not in a dire situation right then. I mean, it's not a critical thing. When a police officer's out on a beat or something, and there's, you know, something that needs to have some sort of action taken, you know, immediately and decisions to be made, that's a little different story. So what he's trying to do is take one argument that does make sense and then, you know, overlay it on a different argument that it doesn't really connect the dots at all, and put it out there as such an emotional issue so that he can kind of get it through. But what he's talking about with the Dream Act, let's just go back to all of that again. None of these people have even read, let alone implement, and this is the specific question that we need to ask each one of them, and each person in the audience needs to, if there's nothing else that's the takeaway right now, is to ask each one of these potential national candidates for president, have they read the 9/11 Commission report? If not, why? And
if they did,
this
is how the 9/11 Commission staff report, the companion document, begins. This is the first paragraph of the preface. And when you hear this, I want you to ask yourself how anybody could favor any kind of a massive amnesty program for millions of people who snuck into the country. Listen to this. It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they are unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the U.S. government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy. We believe, for reasons we discuss in the following pages, it must be made one. And then they go further. Now, this is about smugglers, smuggled aliens. And think of this nonsense. Well, in about 9 years, we'll get operational control over 90%. What, are you kidding me? Listen to this. This is page 61 of the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. In July 2001, the CIA warned of a possible link between human smugglers and terrorist groups, including Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Egyptian Islamic Jihad. Indeed, there is evidence to suggest that since 1999, human smugglers have facilitated the travel of terrorists associated with more than a dozen extremist groups. With their global reach and connections to fraud document vendors and corrupt government officials, human smugglers clearly have the credentials necessary to aid terrorist travel. Is anybody moving quickly to address the lack of integrity to the southern border? No. Are they doing anything about anything else? No. So here's one more quote, and I want you to think about this, because this is exactly the point that they need to be asked. Because when they talk about a massive amnesty program, giving them employment authorization, this is on page 98, and Lou, by the way, read these into congressional records at a number of hearings, Lou Barletta. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, think of the Dreamers, folks, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. And when I have confronted members of Congress on the Republican side, as well as the Democrat side, and I read that to them, they will not answer the question. They will tell me things like, oh, the American people don't have the stomach to deport 11 million people. There's no way we can deport 11 million people. Well, there's probably 30 to 40 million, but they ignore that. And I look at them and I say, okay, so there's only two choices. Either we round up every last illegal alien or we give them all citizenship. Is that what you're telling me? Because that's a false choice. It's just like we
did
this nonsense. You made a point that was brilliant, Lauren. And the point you made was about how Obama takes something that seems to make sense and attributes it to something that has no connection. So look at the minimum wage. Obama says we need a $10.10 an hour minimum wage. If you do the math, do you know what $10.10 an hour works out to for somebody working a 40-hour work week and works 52 weeks? $21,000 a year. What income equality are we talking about? Because no one's asking, who do you want to make me equal to? Even if it's $15 an hour, which is what the fast food workers in New York and elsewhere are demanding, that works out to just over $30,000. But you see, income equality is the new war cry. We can't deport them all. That's the war cry. But there's a middle ground, and there needs to be a connection with reality, and there's no connection. So when you have O'Malley talking on the one hand, we're going to help the Americans. The middle class is hanging by a thread. He said that. The middle class is hanging by a thread. you mean to tell me that a $10 an hour or even a $15 an hour minimum wage will save the middle class? Is $30,000 a year a middle class wage, Lauren?
No, it's not. No, but and ultimately, it's, you know, the thing that needs to happen in order for America to prosper again, and let's not even talk about, it's so against how we were originally founded anyway, because it becomes a class section, and we went away from the whole feudal section. We went away from the poverty, lower, you know, the Indians have it, in India,
caste system.
Exactly. We're like almost third world culture way of thinking now. And you know, it's true, you know, I always considered we were considered upper middle class and educated. And education was more important, if not, than money and success. You know, when you define success. But at the end of the day, it is not even about the money. It is about the freedom. And what ends up happening with the economy is when the free markets are allowed to work, and that really means that government is limited. And our government, when limited and when functioning in the way it's supposed to, there are certain things that government absolutely needs to do. And part of that is, you know, our military and security, homeland security. And then there are certain things that they really don't have any business being in. And if they open it up to free markets, you find that competition in the marketplace elevates everybody. It creates better products. It creates more inventions and more products anyway. It has an atmosphere and an environment for entrepreneurialism. And those are the things that make America exceptional. And when you have over-bloated government regulations that come down and, you know, make it virtually impossible for, you know, John Doe to go down and start a small business with his widgets, then, you know, you once again put it more on the government where it's not government's job. And as you and I both know, things that are to be left for the government where they're supposed to be doing things, if they focused on that and did that well that would be great. But when they start getting into too many things, it's not a good thing.
But that's not the issue here. But immigration
enforcement is one of them. And they're not doing it.
It is, but now look what we're doing. You were just talking about education. And if you go into a university, mm-hmm. and I've had opportunities to speak on college campuses everywhere from Yale to Columbia to the Chapman Law School, to Central Washington. I wish there'd be more opportunities. If any of you folks out there know of opportunities for discussions on campuses, we need to have these discussions. Because when you ask most kids...
Try to get up to MIT.
If anybody knows the way, I'll go tomorrow. I mean, but here's the point. Do you know the second biggest...
Yeah.
Source of personal indebtedness in the United States next to home mortgages, you know what it is?
Student loans. Yeah,
$1.2 billion. What in the world are these kids spending the money and the time and the effort if you can't get a decent job? This is an article that was about what is happening at Disney, okay? And they said that the use of H-1B visas to displace U.S. workers is getting more attention in Congress. In response to Southern California Edison's use of foreign labor, 10 U.S. senators recently asked three federal agencies to investigate H-1B use. But one agency, the U.S. Department of Labor, wrote back last week and told the lawmakers that large H-1B firms are not prohibited from displacing U.S. workers as long as they meet certain conditions, such as paying them at least $60,000 a year. Well, $60,000 a year is the bottom of a middle-class wage. However, what happens to that engineer or the programmer or the scientist with the PhD who's making $150,000 a year, which is a reasonable paycheck for someone with a PhD, and they say to him, hey, Charlie, you've been great for 15 years, you're productive, you have all these patents attributed to you, you're fabulous, but you know what? We have a guy from India willing to come here to work for $62,000 a year, so we have a problem. Do we keep you at $150,000? Or do we bring in somebody who's willing to work for less than half your wage? We'll make you a deal, Charlie. You want to keep your job? We're not unreasonable. If I have to bring that guy in, he's going to have to be trained, and we're going to have to pay moving expenses. We're not going to offer you $62,000. That would be silly. We'll give you $75,000. We're going to cut your salary in half if you're willing to stay on. Now, where is this guy going to go? So what we're now doing is devaluing the value of education and skills. We are now, folks, in the middle of a race to the bottom. there should be no $60,000 caveat. You see, if it was a real free market, they wouldn't be able to do this. And yet there are people that favor free markets who say, well, you know, it's dollars and cents. It's dollars and cents, but by destroying the middle class, you're destroying America's consumer base. Henry Ford made certain that his Model T cars were inexpensive enough that the people who built them were able to buy them. You see, what's happened now is the American consumer is being priced out of the market for so much. And that's why, again, going back to my brilliant son who said to me, Dad, do you notice most of the car ads today? And I want you to notice this, folks. See if my son's not right. He's the smarter of the two of us. Because he realized something that I had missed. Most of the car commercials don't tell you what the car costs anymore. Right? What do they tell you? How much you can lease it for. Because more and more Americans are finding car ownership to be financially out of reach. So what's the alternative?
Mm-hmm.
They lease the vehicles. And that's a measure about how far the economy has slid. We're being told that the average family today is earning roughly the same salary as 20 years ago. There's only one small problem. Their costs haven't stagnated from where it was 20 years ago. Those costs have gone through the roof. So now people are finding themselves running faster on an escalator that's going down than they're trying to go up. And the result?
Mm.
More Americans are losing their homes to foreclosure. More Americans are falling below the poverty line. And then they start to depend on government programs like food stamps because they can't put food on the table, which further burdens the economy. So who's making out? The mega wealthy. Who's getting hammered? America and Americans. And the politicians are complicit in this.
Right. Well, you
do I make sense? I hope I make sense to you, Lauren.
You make sense to me. I'm sure the people who are listening in the audience, too. I mean, I believe that you're making sound arguments, and I'm hoping that it's inspiring the people who are listening to start to get involved. And I think if we can just really, you know, there are so many issues, and it's a full court press on you know, a lot of these issues. What's happened now is there's an interrelationship between governmental entities and then, you know, nonprofits and then for-profits. And we see things, you know, that are pushing and you know, it's insidious because the average person is just busy with their lives and trying to get things going and doing things. But like things like Alabama Appleseed, you know, I mean, that's got like the American Express, you know, guy who runs that, you know, sitting on the board of this nonprofit. And you see you've got a bunch of nonprofits sort of, you know, pushing sort of different agendas and things like that. And we find that when you're dealing with larger corporations or big money, right, really big money, it's hard for the average person to think that they can do anything about that. That being said, I submit that it is always the right time to do the right thing. And even though people think that they're just, you know, one small family or one, you know, voice in the wilderness, it's still, I think, important to take some action and whatever that is with discernment. And so I believe that this 9/11 commission report is the key to holding people accountable. And then at the end of the day, you do see some justice kind of come around. Sometimes it takes a long time, but you finally do see, you know, the FBI picks up some perpetrator has been, you know, wandering the streets, you know, looking like he's obviously totally successful and living the life of Riley, like I'm thinking of Hasser, you know, or whatever. But, you know, sometimes justice takes a
Nobody's
while.
Nobody's above the law. No one's above the law, but there's something else
no,
there also
that's
that
right,
you
that's
hit
right.
on. You know, history is written by only a few people. See, everyone who thinks, oh, I'm just one guy, I want you to think about this. During the Second World War, tens of millions of people were killed. Millions of people fought in the battles, correct? Yet if I say World War II, I dare anybody out there to come up with more than a dozen or two dozen names of the leaders who were in power, good or bad, you know, Mussolini or Eisenhower. I don't care. The point that I make, how many names quickly come to mind when you think of the Second World War or the First World War or the United States space program or anything? You see, history is always written by just a handful of men and women who at that moment in history stepped forward and made all the difference in the universe. And to sit there and say, I'm just one person. Yes, you are, but think of how many times that one person who stepped up, Winston Churchill, correct? Dwight Eisenhower,
yeah. And
General George Patton. You know, you're talking about people, we think they're giants. They're not giants. They were just men who had an understanding. Think back to the Revolution. And you think about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and Benjamin Franklin. A handful of names. And they created a country,
right.
That handful of people. So, you know, I don't really feel that, you know, oh, this isn't a fair fight. It's a very fair fight if the American people are willing to make the effort. Yes, if you sit home and say, I can't and I won't, then, of course, you're not going to prove yourself to be a liar, are you? We limit ourselves the most when we talk about what we can't or won't do. But when we step up and say, yeah, I can do that. Let me tell you, the Wright brothers said, yeah, we can do that, and they built an airplane. Chuck Yeager climbed into the cockpit of the X-1 in October of 1947, and as he called it, he punched a hole in the sky and broke the sound barrier. Alan Shepard got into that Freedom 7 Mercury capsule on May 5th, 1961, and became the first American to fly in space. So it takes that individual who can look at the challenge and say, yeah, I'm up for it. Let's do it. Bring it on. And that's the mindset
I hope
I make sense to you, Lauren.
Well, you do, and I'm hoping that you're making sense to the audience and anybody who's going to listen to this, you know, later on in an archive. And I think that you're absolutely right. And really, the American personality, or the, if there is a personality, because we're so diverse, and yet, you know, there's a unity, or used
e pluribus
to be a unity.
Unum,
or,
right? E pluribus unum.
That's right.
Out of one.
That's right.
Out
we're
of
not a
multicultural.
Yes, that's right. And you know, the sort of mentality was, you know, was sort of that not never never quit, but it was you know, you fall seven times, you get up eight, and so you just keep going, and this is the thing that we've kind of been spoon fed from the top down. That's just incorrect information from, you know, people in leadership, presidential positions. Things are too big to fail. No, sorry, sir, that is absolutely not true. Things can fail. It's how you learn from what happened.
And it's about making people accountable, so that, you know, when I listen to Leona Helmsley utter those despicable words, I don't pay taxes, the little people pay taxes. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And, I mean, she's in
like
the ground somewhere, and I suspect the worms didn't enjoy the meal much either. But
right.
Nobody's above
right.
the law. We're all born, we all come into the world the same way, and one way or the other, we all go out the same way. And what happens in between is what distinguishes us. And for anybody to have the unmitigated chutzpah to stand there and say, I don't pay taxes, the little people pay taxes, baloney. And these folks who think they're in control need to be brought in for a hard landing. You know, falling doesn't hurt, but boy, that sudden stop will get you every time. By the way, Lauren, before I forget, you're also a chief legal counsel to an organization. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and put a website out there?
Well, it is. I've been blessed to meet Dr. Steve Moisey, who came through the immigration system in the legal.
What's his name? I'm sorry.
Way.
Say it slower so
Dr.
everybody gets it.
Steve, M-O-Y-S-E-Y. And he is
Moisey.
Actually up
okay.
in Boston. Yeah, in Boston. And he, you know, created this website, and it's got a few contributors from different areas of you know, realms that they practice in. I'm just honored that they even consider me to be somewhat of a learning expert in the area of constitutional law and just legal issues. But I've written quite a few articles there, and it can be found at www.americainformed.org.
America which? I'm sorry, say it again. You want people to go
America,
to the website.
Yes, americainformed.org. So it's, you know,
America informed.
Dot org.
Right, one word.
Yeah.
Perfect. AmericaInformed.org.
Yes. And if you click on there, you can see more about who I am. It's got a bio on me there. And it's also under the Constitution is where my articles will be found. And so I've written on a few things and have done a lot of research. And it's just been a lot of fun to be able to do this research and then, you know, connect the dots, so to speak. Logic, it was one of my favorite classes. I love it. And I would love to be able to continue to use it to just educate people. And then ultimately, maybe, you know, I always think that there are people who are smarter than I am in higher positions that can kind of hold these people accountable. But it's not seeming to happen. So I mean, I feel like that's why you just have to keep doing these things, because at some point, you know, Lindsey Graham needs to answer those questions. What is going on with the 9/11 Commission report? And he's been very easy to skate around all of this, and yet he takes so much credit for so many different things that haven't been clear. You know,
I'm glad you're mentioning Graham, because this is the guy who was out there just a couple of days ago when he talked about running for the presidency and said, well, I was in the military, and I visited the Middle East, and I've been to, I believe he said, Afghanistan. Okay. But this is the same guy who says that when people run the border, it's not a big deal. We should give them lawful status. And I'd love to see Mr. Strategist answer the question, how do you overcome those threats and challenges that were clearly identified by the 9/11 Commission that make it clear that providing identity documents to people who snuck into the country? You know, they gloss over this thing. Oh, they're undocumented. Well, first of all, undocumented means they have no valid ID, which is disturbing. So now you're going to give them valid ID? But, you know, as an agent,
right,
if I went out and when I started, one of the early squad assignments I had was something called area control. And what our job was to just go out and find illegal aliens. Very simple. So we developed friends in the police department, so they pulled a guy over for speeding or he was drunk, and there were three guys in the car with him, and they turned out to be illegally present. I'd get a call from the precinct. They'd say, hey, Mike, we just caught a couple. I'd go down, pick them up, and we'd process them. It was a very easy job. It wasn't, you know, long-term field investigative work. It wasn't investigative intensive, usually, although even those sometimes led us to terrorists and drug trafficking organizations. You know, half the FBI's 10 most wanted get arrested by the police doing routine police work, and of course the FBI takes credit for it, but the 10 most wanted very often are encountered by police doing car stops or responding to other crimes. But meanwhile, you know, what Mr. Graham and the others are ignoring completely is the fact of being out there and arresting illegal aliens provided us with this opportunity to find more stuff that was going on through something that's an accepted principle in law enforcement called randomness. Just plucking someone off the street, you never know what happens when you start to dig a little bit. So we would go out there and arrest illegal aliens simply for working illegally, simply for being here illegally. And it taught us the value of enforcing the immigration laws from within the interior of the United States. So when I listen to Mr. Graham saying, oh, they just snuck into the country, we're going to give them ID, nonsense. And by the way, when we arrested somebody, if my boss came up to me and said, you know, who did you arrest? What you got, Mike? And if I said to the guy, oh, he's a ship jumper, okay, he's an EWI. And the term EWI, for those of you who've listened to my program, you probably know the term. If you're new, it means entered without inspection, EWI. So in the jargon of an immigration agent, that was an EWI. That's somebody who snuck into the country. We had no idea how long they were here. We had no way of knowing who they really were. In some cases, we weren't even sure about their country of citizenship. So to gloss over it and say, oh, they entered undocumented, it's called, at the minimum, trespassing. And if you want to have clarity, the difference between an immigrant and an illegal alien is comparable to the difference between a house guest and a burglar. Go back to Schumer. Go back to the nonsense. If you trespass on the Brooklyn Bridge, I want you to go to jail for 5 years. That's what he said. 5 years. Half a decade in a cage. But if you sneak into America in a time that we worry about criminals and terrorists, he wants to give you citizenship. Go back to that statement from the 9/11 Commission report.
That's right. You are onto something right there. And this isn't, you know, this is no longer, you know, if people say they're going to run for president, come on, they've got to have thick skin. And I don't care if you have $30 million or $500 billion or whatever you have. You know, Lindsey's got a big war chest. That's, you know, everybody, he just became senator again, right? So we all remember how he beat his chest about how much money he had, right? At the end of the day, when you have your judgment day, money isn't the only thing on the accounting sheet then. But my point here is, they get their staffers sometimes personal, and there's so much infighting within the realms of the, you know, political process. And I'm telling you, this presidential election, I'm not going to throw any punches for any one of the candidates. What I would like to do, and what I submit that we all do, is we go back and we say, guys, if you're going to run for president, this is no longer amateur hour. you need to make yourself accessible to all the constituents and to answering some of these serious questions. And if you're not going to do that, if you're not going to put in writing the answers to some of these very serious questions about what it would be if you became president, and, you know, why haven't you read the 9/11 Commission report, and why did you completely ignore it when you drafted the legislation for the Dream Act?
I'll be honest with you. I have a better one. If they haven't read that report, they just disqualified themselves. I'm sorry, because
I love it.
14, that report was prepared over a decade ago. It was completed. You've had 10 years to read your homework. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's on the required. I didn't even read Cliff Notes when I went to college. This is about America's national security. If that's not your priority, you just disqualified yourself. How's that for a premise?
I'm on board with you, totally. And I'm also on board with using Marco. I'm calling out Lindsey Graham, but let's just use Marco Rubio. Let's use Scott Walker. Let's use Ted Cruz. Let's really get Ted Cruz. He's out there, right? Isn't he a Tea Party favorite? He's a little, you know, I'd like to see his answers. None of them. I'm skeptical about each one of what they have to say until they actually say it and back it up. And this is something that we should, you know, in the way we've worked the system now and in the way it's become is, you know, people fawn over these people. And, you know, they like, get involved, and it's like, okay, I'm part of this group, and it gives you sort of an identity or something for, like, a short brief period of time. That's not the point. That's not the long-term goal.
The biggest group that
should
give you identity is being an American.
Yeah.
That's the group.
And we need to define that clearly. And that does not mean that you go to Walmart and they, like, offer free translators at the Walmart pharmacy right now for every single language that you could imagine. I took a picture of it. I'll text it to you. I was like, what's up with that? And then I haven't researched it any further. I just thought it was bizarre. And it actually tied into, we didn't have time to talk about any more of the NSA, but it made me think, you know, beyond in these asymmetrical battles that we fight, beyond just telephones, how easy would it be for somebody to just go into Walmart at a pharmacy place and say, you know what, I need an Arabic translator or Chinese or Korean. They have like a couple languages I've never even heard of in my whole life, you know, let alone could I even understand them, right? So I'm standing here in my own country in Walmart, and there's actually a usurpation of my own language where people are being offered all these translations. Therefore,
you know, my mom came here as a 14-year-old girl from Poland ahead of the Holocaust. She had to leave her mother behind. I was named for my grandmother, my mother's mother, who was killed in Poland. But I want you to know that her first order of business, as soon as she got off the boat at Ellis Island, was to start to learn English. My dad's parents came from Russia, Romania. First order of business, my grandpa, my middle name was my father's name, William. And the first order of business, at night, by candlelight, after dinner, they put the dishes away. He took out a Yiddish newspaper from today with yesterday's daily news, because it took them a day to translate it and publish it as the foreword, which was a Yiddish paper. And he sat there with the two newspapers and a notepad and a pen, and he taught himself English so that he could get a driver's license and so that he could start a roofing company. And he was in his 30s.
He said, I'm
an American.
Story. Yeah. I love that story. Now, see,
and my
story,
father told me that he was...
Like they've taken that story...
But the point is, it was about being proud of being an American. And nobody said, oh, it's the Depression, I'm going home. How many times do they interview somebody today? And the guy is holding a lottery ticket, and they do the man in the street interview, and the guy with the heavy accent. I don't care where he's from. I don't care where he's from. Mm-hmm. This isn't about one. By the way, immigration isn't about Mexico. I don't know how in the world this is what it's become. The greatest number of lawful immigrants admitted to America don't come from Latin America. They come from China. Okay? So let's stop the nonsense.
Russia,
this has
Russia's
nothing to do with
bunch,
Latinos. Yeah. This is another lie that we're being spoon-fed. But how many times do you see them go up to the guy with the lottery ticket in his hand, and the guy has a heavy accent, and they say to him, hey, you know, the lottery today is $130 million. What are you going to do if you win? And what does the guy say? I'm going to go home to my country. Well, where in the world are you now? My grandfather never thought of going back to Russia during the Depression, but you have people winning a lottery saying, I'm going to go back to my country? I find it remarkable.
Me, the enemy comes to lie, steal, and destroy. I mean, that's just, pick, and I say enemy, you know, generally, but that's just if you're looking at Art of War or you're looking at any sort of thing, the enemy comes to lie, steal, and destroy, and we just can't accept that, that that is the message anymore. That is not the message. The message of America is the story of your father. The message of America is the story of you getting up every day and working so hard in this area of your expertise and raising great, raising a great family and being a good family man and standing by, you know, people and really defending the vulnerable and standing up for what's right. This is what America is. And there's plenty of people out there doing it. And they just, that's not the message that we hear. So what we have to do is just bind that, stand and, you know, stand and stop, you know, letting that get into our head and be the chatter in our heads. Because when we allow that in, it becomes very easy for us to take, name any one of those potential presidential candidates and the spin they're putting on their power play, you know, and just, you know, at the end of the day, they cannot justify.
They can't. And look at what happened after the riots in Baltimore. Oh, we have to address the poverty. We have to address the, how many speeches did we hear about poverty? And now what's happened that the coverage is gone, the cameras are gone, the floodlights are gone. What has changed in Baltimore today? I'll tell you what's changed is more drugs on the street because they'd broken into the pharmacies, so the murders are up. The police have got a very clear message. You know, when I was an agent, we had a very wonderful expression, Lauren. Big cases, big problems. Little cases, little problems. No cases, no problems.
No problems.
If you tell the police that no matter what happens, if you don't get killed, you're going to get sued. If you don't get sued, you're going to get prosecuted. If you don't get prosecuted, you're going to get fined or fired. And look, I'm not going to get into what happened in Baltimore. Literally, the jury is out on all that. And I certainly have no tolerance for abuse of authority, whether it's a politician or a law enforcement officer. But we don't know what the facts are. And I don't want this to be a rush to judgment either. You know, this whole process is a deliberative process. We saw this whole thing happen in St. Louis, where people were making allegations that were false, just like this terrorist that was killed up in Boston. And his brother immediately said, oh, he was on the phone and he was shot in the back. Fortunately, there was a video. He wasn't on the phone and he wasn't shot in the back. And the agents and the police officers actually retreated rather than shoot him until he lunged for them with this hunting knife or this combat knife, and at that point all bets are off. But how easy is it for someone to yell fire in that crowded theater, make a false statement, and if we go from becoming a country of law, which is so easy given an administration that has no respect for the law, for the Constitution, for the checks and balances that our government provides, and we become a lynch mob, then we've lost our country. The whole point to having a judicial system is that we know that the system will deal with the criminals. The system will take care of those who do harm to our families. And when we stop believing in the system, and I wrote about this a couple of years ago, and I said that we were on the slippery slope to anarchy. And all that this administration has done, and aided and abetted by Congress, by the way, both sides of the aisle, is to accelerate this process of anarchy. Because today, if you come to America illegally, we don't care that you're illegal. We can't wait to do things for you. They're about to take a dreamer and make him a lawyer here in Staten Island in New York. This is lunacy. Yeah. We admit more than 1 million lawful immigrants every year. Why would you bother? Why would you bother through this cumbersome legal? By the way, I got to make one other point. The dreamers are getting free legal help. The people coming legally have to pay for their own lawyers. When I file a tax return, I pay for my accountant. But if you're an illegal alien, then you get free legal help. Do you know that the aliens who were given amnesty under Reagan, by the way, back in 86, do you know that their amnesty files were sealed? We were not allowed to share them with the FBI or the New York City Police Department. I had cases where they came to me and said, I need a photograph of this guy. I need an address. He's killed, we believe, 3 people, and we're afraid he's going to kill more people. I said, you better go to court and get an order from a judge. If I show you the amnesty file, I can be criminally prosecuted, lose my job, and everything I own. Why are we protecting people who broke the law? And this happened under Reagan, by the way. Whereas if that was an alien who came here legally, became a citizen, that whole file has to be turned over for obvious reasons. But if you came illegally and got a Reagan amnesty, you were shielded from detection by the law, at least that part. What you did afterwards, once you got lawful status, yeah, we could share that. But the amnesty file, we were prohibited by law from sharing that unless we got a court order from federal court saying we could turn that over. Why? Why are we providing that level of protection for people who came here by violating our laws?
Typically, that just goes into the mix of why we're allowing so many things that are completely it's injustice that over and over again. Why are we allowing that, and why is that happening? It's schematic. It is on purpose. It is so flagrantly, incompetently ridiculous that it can be nothing other than an intentional plan that's just not your and my plan. You know what I mean? So,
Well, you know, my dad used to say that I would teach people how they should treat me by demonstrating what I was willing to accept. Folks, I am telling you that we need to be involved. You know, Lauren, what you do as an activist and what these groups you advise is amazing. It's important work. We all have got to roll up our sleeves and push back, because we're being pushed into a corner. We are losing our jobs. We're losing our wages. People are losing their lives. When you look at the drug trade, when you realize there's a huge heroin epidemic across this country, that's the real metric about border security.
Oh, yeah. And you mentioned the human trafficking. I mean, human trafficking is worse in South Carolina. And I went down when I was on my mission trip. It's bad in Belize. It's really bad in Belize. But it's really bad in South Carolina. We're a port state. We have ports right next to, between Charleston and Savannah, Georgia. And I'll tell you what, it is a third world culture. We are allowing the enemy to win. And when I say enemy, it could be the drugs, it could be the human trafficking. It's just the insidious underbelly, the subterranean that used to be very hidden or not, it wasn't the mainstream. The underbelly is becoming the mainstream. And that is on purpose. That has been schematically, and these are the people that, half of these, Congress people and senators have been up in there for a quarter of a century. When I say a quarter of a century, I'm too long,
But people like Jeff Sessions, I don't want to see his term limited. We, the people, should be limiting the terms of these people. If they're good, you keep them. If they're lousy, you fire them. They shouldn't get tenure. They have tenure, the power of the incumbency, because we're lazy and foolish.
I just don't think that that's true, though, because I think a lot of people go to vote and...
You're coming in garbled now, Lauren.
Sorry. My T-Mobile might be getting off, but the thing is that sometimes it's hard for voting them out. I know a lot of people have used a lot of good efforts and, to vote these people out now. There's some things that go on with the way
I'm gonna make a suggestion. When there are town hall meetings, you have to go there and you have to be very clear in the questions that you ask. Don't give any wiggle room. Too many people are where do you stand on securing the border? I'm for the fence. And everybody says, yay. Folks, it doesn't work. The better question is, how many agents do you want to hire from within the interior of the United States to enforce the laws? Almost half the illegal aliens in our country did not run the Mexican border. So when you have people like Ted Cruz and all these others stand up, I want a double layer fence. I want a triple layer. I want barbed wire with electricity. It's a joke. It's a subterfuge.
Yeah.
It's a sleight of hand. The question is, what are you going to do to make certain that we stop illegal aliens from getting past the Border Patrol once they get to the interior of the country? What about the guy that gets to that airport and then overstays the visa, takes a job he's not supposed to, becomes involved in other activities? You need to have a vibrant interior enforcement mission. And simply hiring Border Patrol agents does nothing. I was on Newsmax last week with a supposed conservative who kept saying, we need more agents on the border. I said, no, we need agents for the interior.
Yeah.
And J.D. Hayworth, whose program I was on, and he was a member of Congress, and I testified before J.D. 6 weeks after 9/11 over at the Immigration Reform Caucus, said no. He said, Mr. Cutler's point is well taken. What are you willing to do about interior enforcement to bring in the agents? And the guy said, yeah, we need more agents on the border. Because everybody understands that if you have agents in the interior, we could stop the lunacy, folks. That's where the emphasis needs to be, interior enforcement.
You are right.
Anyway,
and,
Lauren,
I am going to have to go. We've done
I'm going to let you go. Thank you for spending.
Thank you for spending time with me. And I'll tell you what I'd like to maybe follow up with is maybe you and I come up with some questions that you know you can put up on your website that people can just ask at these town halls. And
we're losing you, Lauren.
You're losing me?
A little, barely.
Hey, can you hear me?
Now I do.
Sorry. Okay, well, what I was going to say is maybe as we end this, we can make them. You can make some questions, and maybe I can write up a couple, and we can put them on your website. These can
but
be
you
questions
see the,
that
but the questions,
can use.
It's a good idea, but I'll tell you the problem. The questions aren't enough. We have to be able to discern the answers, and that's why they really need to read the articles. There's no cliff notes here. You know, I had a woman email me and say to me, Mr. Cutler, you need to understand the principle of KISS. KISS means keep it simple, stupid. And I said, you know, my articles take about 15 minutes to read, maybe 20 minutes, the longer ones. But I want you to understand that if I simply put something on the website that could fit on a bumper sticker, that's a good slogan, but it's not going to educate anybody. And if you're worried about investing 20 minutes, think about our young men and women in the military who invest a year at a time in hostile countries under very arduous, difficult, trying circumstances, away from their friends and family, away from their homes, and in very often life-threatening situations. If they could spend a year under those circumstances, you can take 20 minutes to read an article and really acquire some good, solid information. Because if I say Interior Enforcement, they'll talk about, let's go and do employer sanctions. Let's have mandatory E-Verify. And if you don't understand E-Verify, that sounds like a solution. But it means nothing if we're giving lawful status to people who shouldn't be getting it in the first place. So, and I don't expect to have a dialogue at a town hall meeting where they're going to go into detail. But you see, the whole trick, just like in a courtroom, and as a lawyer you know this, it's like boxing. I boxed as a kid. You jab and then you punch. You jab and then you punch. The first question is the jab. That knockout punch is the follow-up question. And so you need to have the background to know where that follow-up question fits in and what response is acceptable and what response tells you a whole different story. Do you think I'm right? Hi, Lauren.
Sorry, I had it on mute. Sorry, I was. I do. And actually, one of my friends said that they didn't get the radio to come up. So hopefully this went out to all of our audience and everything
it
like that.
It should be, and the podcast, I don't know why this seems to sometimes be a problem, but the podcasts always come up with that problem. If you give it a little time, the podcast will be up. So,
okay.
Anyway,
I don't know
Lauren
if
Martell, if you want
to...
If you want to put the your website out one more time.
Okay. Well, I have martellawhiltonhead.com, which is my you know, law office down here in Hilton Head. And then I have my site that's up on americainform.org. And
perfect.
Those are two great sites, and I always am so honored and humbled to speak with you. I will look forward to talking to you regularly, and as we embark on this presidential election, you know, I would say I'm not – on anybody's
I'm running out of time, Lauren.
Certainly...
I will
okay.
Speak to you. I'm sorry to cut you short. Have a great weekend.
All right.
Thanks for joining us.
God bless.
Us.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Lauren Martell. I want to thank all of you for spending the last 90 minutes with us. I hope it's been helpful to you. You know, if knowledge is power, my goal is to empower you by providing you with knowledge, with information you're not going to get in the mainstream medium. Please, folks, visit my website, michaelcutler.net. Go to CAPSWeb, C-A-P-S, CAPSWeb.org, front page magazine, Progressives for Freedom. But I want you to remember, folks, as I always like to say at the end of my programs, that democracy is not a spectator sport. Please get out there, get involved, and remember, history truly is written by individuals who at that moment in history do that which makes all the difference in the world, and we are all, one way or another, capable of doing just that. Thanks again. I look forward to being with you again next week, same time right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. Good night, everybody.